This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 103rd in a series of interviews with security gurus and also security technology reporters and bloggers. And I'm super pleased to have today with me Brian Krebs. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Gary.
Brian Krebs is a reporter and blogger whose new school website, KrebsOnSecurity.com, is world famous. Brian was a reporter for the Washington Post before forming Krebs on Security, and he was that reporter from 95 to 2009. He wrote thousands of pieces for the Security Fix blog and many front page stories. And Brian has a BA in International Studies from George Mason, and he lives in Northern Virginia, where it's absolutely gorgeous today, with his wife. His book, Spam Nation, will be released on November 18th. So thanks for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
You were an Apple II guy way back in the early 80s, and so was I. In fact, my machine led indirectly to my work in software security. Do you think that growing up with a machine in the house impacted your career?
Yeah, I've given this a lot of thought. As a kid, I did spend a ridiculous amount of time tying up our phone lines at home, working on an Apple II and then an Apple II Plus, I think it was.
Yeah, yeah.
I was on the dang bulletin boards, these text-based communities and downloading all kinds of crap.
Of course.
I'm sure it had.
You probably had a source account and CompuServe and all that stuff back in the day.
I don't remember what we had. My dad was into, like, he would go and every day log our, like maybe every few days we'd log into the Dow Jones thing and like download all their stock information and
right.
start doing charts and
right.
stuff. And I was like, oh, you know, hot dog. But eventually, I think, I'm not really sure what happened. I think maybe I discovered girls or something and I forgot about the computers for a little bit.
It worked the other way for me. There was this girl who had a project in high school. I'm trying to remember her name. I think it was Janet Gage. And she needed some help, and I could do it on the computer. I made her a program, which was too big for an Apple II to load all at once, actually worked. And she was like, really very, it was rewarding.
Yes. Well, you were always an overachiever.
Right? Who knows? But the idea of growing up around a machine and doing a little bit of coding and really understanding how something like that works, I think that helps to ground any sort of reporting in technology. And a lot of people don't have that, so maybe that's an advantage for you.
You know, I think you're probably right in one respect, at least, and that is, a lot of reporting is kind of drudgery. I mean, people think of reporting is sometimes of this, what they see in the movies about reporters, running around chasing down politicians or doing things like that. I mean, for the most part, most reporting is as boring as all get out, and it's data, it's data intensive work. It's half the time you sit there and you spend you put all your blood, sweat and tears into something and it turns out to be a pile of nothing,
right?
And you got nothing to show for it, and it's frustrating. And I think, the same thing probably true with trying to produce a program or something that you really want to behave a certain way or look a certain way, and maybe it works out, maybe it doesn't.
I mean, reporting does have this thing that should have this thing called fact-checking, which it used to be better at, and I know that you're extremely careful with that. Usually it's the editors that have to ride herd over the fact-checking component, at least in the old, old school days. So, that, I don't know.
Well, look, fact-checking is, it is a luxury increasingly in journalism, I think. Having somebody looking over your shoulder and different sets of eyes, just to question, even just to, not just to fact-check your facts or the spelling of people's names and all that is very important, but just to somebody there to question your assumptions about things.
Right.
Which is, as a journalist, you get yourself in trouble really quickly if you're not checking your assumptions at the door as often as possible.
You know what's interesting? When you're breaking a system, it's often a very good move, too. if you remove assumptions, systems often break in surprising ways. So if you can get to the assumptions that the architect or the designer or the engineer was making and make them disappear, the systems just crumble. And that's always a good, very high-level technique, but a very, very useful one.
That's interesting. Well, who knew there were such parallels?
So I have a BA in philosophy, which is possibly only slightly less lucrative than your BA in international studies. Did your early work inform your capabilities in understanding the Russian culture?
Not really. When I was pursuing the international relations thing, it was mainly because I had decided, since I took so many classes in Spanish, I decided I wanted to, I could double, you know, almost double major in something, and I did it. I had slightly different goals in mind when I was finishing my degree.
Not becoming a reporter.
Well, actually, I was on the high school newspaper.
Oh, were you?
For several years, and with your buddy Dwayne Nitz.
Yes, Dwayne is a good musician.
He is. He's great. And so he was writing about sports stuff, and I was writing about, God, I don't know, just whatever, and just random observations. And you know, she was a 10th grade English teacher there, and she was in charge of the school newspaper, and she wanted to make me editor, and I just didn't have any interest in that because I don't really like managing other people.
Mm-hmm.
But then that was another thing that I sort of forgot about until after my first dead-end job.
Yeah, good. Yeah, good luck with that. It turns out that your passions catch you in the end, I think, is the
they
real...
They do, don't they?
That's the real way it goes. So I've been working with Richard Danzig, who you may know. He used to be the Secretary of the Navy a long time ago.
Oh, yes.
On getting Washington to understand what they call cybersecurity. Cyber. He has a deeply disturbing view of MUD versus MAD. So it's mutually assured destruction versus mutually unassured destruction, MUD versus MAD. And the notion is that if we have cyber kinetic capability and we can make second strike possibility go away in the nuclear realm, that makes it much more likely that people will do a first strike, which is really, really, truly deeply disturbing. Never really thought of it until he expressed it clearly in a paper that he wrote for CNES. What do you think of the risks and the hype surrounding cyber war versus the reality of cyber crime that you're steeped in every day?
There are a lot of questions in there, but I think a lot of what gives Washington pause about taking the whole quote-unquote cyber issue seriously is everybody's sort of been holding their breath for a long time for some big offensive attack that's going to, you know, rock the various services and the generals.
Yeah,
and
the cyber Pearl Harbor, blah, blah.
Right, the Pearl Harbor. And, you know, look, this we've been in a cyber war with our adversaries or, you know, not our allies for many years now. And it's only starting to dawn on, I think, a small cadre of folks in D.C. about how badly that's gone for us, for our side over the last few years. I mean, we are the world's most technology-dependent nation, for sure. And, you know, our vulnerabilities reflect that. So just because we haven't seen that cyber Armageddon attack, it doesn't mean that we're not already losing that war, because we are.
Right. I think that there's this irony, though, that I want to compare it to the cyber crime thing. Really, if you look at the root cause of all this stuff, it's very similar. So if we build stuff that's not quite so sucky, it's going to help us with both cyber war defense, or making sure that cyber war doesn't happen, and help us to address the cyber crime problem.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right in that both of the problems stem from an underappreciation of how much we rely on these technologies.
Got it.
This has been a busy year for me, Gary. I think I've done 24 speaking engagements so far this year.
I hope you're getting paid a lot to do that.
It's a lot.
That's
and
good.
I'll do a couple more, and then a book tour next month. So In fact, I'm doing one later this week. You know, I think what's interesting is visiting, so many of these companies I've spoken at have been Fortune 500 companies. It's been really interesting to, you know, in conversations during, before and after the talk with these folks, really to hear the questions they're asking and hear the answers they're giving me in response to my questions, which are essentially trying to get a sense of how clued in the leadership within that organization is about their reliance on technology and
right.
computer systems and,
right.
and information security. And the point I try to get across to these organizations with varying degrees of success is, look, if you look at any modern business, it runs 100% on information technology. Whether the people who run that company want to acknowledge that, that's the truth these days.
Yep.
If the technology breaks down, everything stops. So, but you wouldn't often know this from looking at what companies invest in IT security relative to their overall dependence on it. And I'm not just talking about money. You know, it's not a spending issue. I don't think it's a priority issue.
Right. I think that's true. You know, the data that you get back looking at that sort of thing differs by vertical pretty vastly. So the people in financial services were really woken up by Sarbanes-Oxley, which made them wonder where those accounting numbers came from anyway. And if I'm going to sign that you can put me in jail, if they're not right, I need to know that they're right. And they
right.
were surprised to find out, holy cow, there's a huge pile of software under there that we were assuming was always going to work properly. And I think that got those guys on the stick. The rest of the world and many other disciplines, like retail, for example, haven't quite gotten the message, although they've been getting huge wake-up calls lately, I suppose.
Yeah, and I don't think they have still gotten the message. From where I sit, I mean, it really comes down to a fundamental, and I don't care what business you're in. If you're in the making widgets business or in the selling retail goods or in shipping cruise missiles, you know, I think if you're, the people that run the organization haven't undergone a critical shift in thinking about how they protect their systems, then, you know, they're probably way more compromised than they know.
Right.
You can usually tell the companies that have Crew One about this because the board or the people in charge of the operations of the organization are asking, above all, one very critical question, which is, how much of our scarce IT security resources are we spending trying to keep the bad guys out versus, you know, figuring out when they get in as quickly as possible and stop the bleeding.
Yeah, I've heard them ask a variety of questions, and the issue, of course, in computer security is that measuring security is a difficult thing to do. It's something I've been working on for about 20 years, and I think that we're making some progress, but there's no magic X-ray machine that you could X-ray your IT infrastructure and say, "All right, we're good to go." and that makes it a challenge to talk to boards about.
I think you're right, but I do think it comes back. You would come back to something we talked about earlier, which is the assumptions thing. You know, having that kind of vigilance really does mean having some smart people who are empowered within your organization, who understand the technology
totally.
And understand the dependence on it, and are empowered to ask questions that make people uncomfortable.
You know what's funny? All those people owned Apple IIs when they were kids. Amazing correlation. So let's shift gears a little. Malware plays a central role in the things that you cover, but most malware is parasitic. You know, it's a result of crappy software. So why do you think that the popular press tends to ignore security engineering, software security, and any solutions to our never-ending parade of hacks and gleefully talks about the next hack all the time?
I'm probably not the best person to answer this question.
Sure you are.
I'm always pointing out the problems. It's a lot more fun to point out the problems than it is to try to suggest solutions with a straight face, you know?
Yeah, but the, I mean, if it gets too relentless, you get a couple of phenomena that occur, which I'm sure you're aware of. One is the cry wolf phenomena, and the other is, well, that's happening to everybody else, but not me, so I must be inherently better. But I think that the world thinks about computer security with a little too much Hollywood thrown in. Mm-hmm. And not quite enough. Gosh, we need some of those people from Volvo that are thinking about safety to work on this, as opposed to the NASCAR guys that are covering spectacular crashes. You got any good ways of interesting the general public in solutions, or do us geeks just have to go be geeks?
Yeah, no. I mean, I don't. I'm sort of. It would be nice if we had something in place that would make companies just care of just a little bit more about shipping code that wasn't Swiss cheese.
Mm-hmm. Maybe some incentives
short of any sort of,
or something.
The short of any sort of liability for that is not going to happen.
Right.
It's just human nature. And, you know, I've said this before, I still believe it. You know, not much changes in that regard until we start to be able to measure the fact that people are dying because of poor software security.
Yep. We talked about that in an FDA thing yesterday, actually.
Yeah.
Or sorry, not yesterday. Virtual yesterday. That was Friday in Washington. And you know, the people at the FDA, at the board that I was talking to, were talking about medical records and patient records and data. And I said, you guys, what if a medical device was used to kill someone? And that surprised them. And, you know, you say, well, look, use the safety issue to do this stuff right.
The scary thing about the medical computer security intersect is, you know, like most things in information technology, it is not enough just to protect these things. You have to keep them working. You have to keep them available. You have to keep them up. And in the context of healthcare, it's even way more important, right? I mean, you know, if critical systems stop working, well, people die, or you know, you can't get access to critical information, people die, and you know, so the availability side of things, which is increasingly a huge problem.
Yep.
With these massive attacks, is a real concern, I think.
Okay, I want to push on the reporting angle one more time from another way.
For sure.
So why can't old media support in-depth security reporting of the sort that you do? And do you think the Post, my cherished local paper, will recover from culling most of its technology ranks, including yourself, but lots of other people too? Or are we going to have like a jillion, you know, so-and-so on such-and-such that are super in-depth and awesome, but not part of a big juggernaut?
You know, I think the traditional media, I like to call the dead tree edition, does a pretty good job of understanding who their target market is.
Gotcha.
In the case of my former employer, I think they correctly identified that you know, their target market cares more about national security stuff than they do about technology or cybercrime, and so.
But as we've just determined, they're really tied up together. They're the same thing.
Yeah, almost. Yeah. So I think, for whatever reason, I think because the Post has really tried to make its mission Washington focused.
Yes.
They want to put a policy slant on stuff.
Got it.
And they want to tell stories that help explain those issues through the lens
to
of
lawyers.
Washington, D.C. Yeah. Well, sure. I mean, but that makes sense. Again, they know their audience.
All right.
So,
right.
So my point is, it's not that the other things aren't important. It's just they may not be priorities for them, which is fine. That was part of the reason we had a fundamental disagreement over this.
Sure. I think it's common for not just the Post, but all sorts of different papers. And the technology desk is way thinner than it used to be. I remember when I was doing the Java security cracking back in the mid-90s, and there were some extremely good reporters who knew their stuff. You know, they actually knew the stuff deeply. There were, of course, some yo-yos, but but when you look around at the tech press today, you just don't seem that see that same deep bench, I don't think.
So, okay, there's a couple things I want to touch on there. One is a lot of major publications a few years back made a hard target effort to figure out what they were good at and then forget about the rest of it.
Right.
And sort of outsource that to somebody else.
Got it.
And so tech coverage tends to be a casualty there.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, you see the tech publications online that cover this stuff increasingly are chasing, there's a lot more competition for the same eyeballs, and so they're pushing their reporters to produce 3, 4, 5, and sometimes 6 stories a day.
Mm-hmm.
That's
where the fact-checking goes
away. The fact-checking thing starts to break down. But not only that, but you just forget about enterprise reporting.
It
doesn't happen in that environment.
I'm glad you had enough guts to just do it. Thanks a lot.
Well, look, for me, it was an existential thing. I mean, I really was freaking out when they eliminated my job at the Post. I didn't really know what else to do except continue doing what I was doing. But then I thought, I can't.
Who's going to pay me for this?
but aside from that, I thought, as long as I'm good at this and people want to read what I have to say, I'll figure that out at some point. And I think I have to some degree. But I guess my focus initially was, how do I differentiate myself? Not get caught up in we have the day? And then I said, there's the answer. Just don't chase the story of the day. Just go write stuff that you can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, I like that. So, you chase an exclusive, but it's a long marathon of a chase, turns out.
Right. Yeah.
And your network really helps a lot, too, which just comes from good reporting. So then people want to tell you and, you become a nexus for information flow.
Right. Yeah. I wouldn't have half the stories I did if I ever named half the people who helped me with my story.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So let's talk about the retail vertical a little bit. I think it's pretty clear to everybody that retail's kind of hosed. So
yeah.
Now that you've given them some religion, do you think they're going to go about their recovery correctly? What's your view of how they've done since the big breaks?
My view of how they've done is, it's kind of a mixed review, I guess. I mean, some of them have gotten the wrong message. They've sort of expedited plans that they were planning anyway to move to chip readers and things like that. But that doesn't really address the underlying problem, which is unencrypted card data, mm-hmm. even for microsecond in your environment. It's just a giant target on your back. So it'll be interesting to see. The companies pay a lot of lip service to things like end-to-end encryption and stuff that can actually help shift the threat to somebody else. But when it comes down to implementing these things, they always screw it up and then they figure out ways to cut corners or, save money. Because at the end of the day, that kind of approach is actually pretty good at shifting the risk to somebody else, but it's also really expensive. So
right.
Retailers will do anything to keep from spending money on security.
Yeah.
Physical security they get, but I still think that most retailers fundamentally, when they look at a cash register even, think of it as physical security.
Right.
And they really don't consider these things that have traditionally been the bailiwick of physical security to be at all related to cyber security. And, of course, there is no difference anymore.
Exactly. So these point-of-sale systems have important design and engineering and implementation aspects that have to be done right.
Right, and you know, so they set these things up, and they go, well, who cares? I mean, they can't connect to the internet. Well, that's not really a speed
bump.
Yeah,
but your HVAC vendor can.
Right. So, yeah.
Well, there's other tricky things, too. So, look, I worked on chip cards and EMV and the global platform stuff personally in the late 90s, like a trillion years ago in a previous life. And I did all the security design, didn't get everything exactly right, but we did a pretty good job. Why do you think, as an example of this, the U.S. is stupidly rushing to adopt chip and signature when we all know that that's just very silly? And even if we did chip and pin, nobody's listening to Ross Anderson, you know, about randomness and so on. Like, what can we do to get these people to do this right going forward instead of just grasping for silliness?
I don't know.
Come on. You're our only hope, Obi-Wan.
No, I'm not. Look, this is not a new technology by any stretch.
I know.
So we're massively playing catch-up in this country.
Do you think that tells you
something about our willingness and preparedness to go the extra mile.
Fair enough. But do you think that those guys even understand the difference between chip and pin and chip and signature?
I think they probably and rightly assume that most consumers don't and don't care. And so why should they? And, you know, look, I asked Visa this very same question, and they wouldn't give me an answer on the record. But they basically said, you know, we don't want to do anything to impede the acceptance of
the flow of commerce, right?
Chip charges, you know, services we charge retailers a hell of a lot more money for. So, if they, you know, if they have any reticence about requiring customers to use a PIN, well, we don't want to stop them from accepting a less secure solution.
There's a reason for that, too, which is the Visa guys can, they have been managing for years to 9 basis points of fraud or less. And that's why they can eat all the fraud, or they can make the retailers eat their chunk. So it is costing the economy, but it's not really costing Visa directly, as long as they're managing fraud properly. So Magstripe has a manageable fraud profile in the United States, is the fact of the matter.
Yeah, I'm sure that they would disagree, but I long ago came to the conclusion that the credit card industry is a bit like Vegas. You know, they're running the house, and you know the rest of us are just playing at the table.
Fair enough.
All right, it's their rules. It's their casino, and you know, you can blame the guy sitting next to you for playing the cards that he did, or not. But and everybody does that. They just point the fingers at somebody else and say it's this guy's problem. And you know, the card associations are laughing all the way to the bank.
Right. Let's talk about something even worse. So, in my view, when it comes to building security in, the government is way behind. Like maybe 5 years or more, especially the contractors. So in terms of the kind of security that you do, intel, operational security in the cybercrime world, do you see the same lag, or is the government, in fact, up with everybody else leading the charge?
Well, Gary, that's a really hard question to answer because the people who'd be able to answer it generally don't talk to people like me.
They talk to me. I still have yet to find something magically amazing in the government. Other than offense.
Do you have a security clearance?
I can't talk about that on this podcast.
Well, okay, so that's probably why they talk to you. You know, most of these guys that actually know how much of a clue the government has on these topics have security clearance.
I don't think so, Brian. I think people hide behind that, and it's a bunch of hooey.
Yeah, I mean, I think that The government likes to overclassify everything. They like to pretend that they're the ones that have they're the vanguard of stuff, and that they alone see the true nature of the threat out there.
Right.
And I think that is probably more than anything stood in the way of most of the rest of the world having a better situation awareness of just how screwed they are.
Right.
And
that's a bad thing. So you're not seeing any sort of way out, pointy tip of the prow that really is that much better than what I'm seeing. And I'm pretty discouraged by the government's approach to security engineering. I mean, really, I'm not kidding when I say they're 5 years behind. And you know that 5 years is an eternity when it comes to tech. Imagine what your phone looked like 5 years ago.
Right. So, yeah, we sort of went through this period where the government stopped, I think, investing in innovation and really building a better mousetrap when it comes to programming and advancing the state of the art.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that's kind of starting to change back the other direction. But I think the government has long ago ceded that to the private sector. But not to say that the private sector is a whole lot more advanced, but that they at least there's a market out there for helping the infrastructure providers, helping important companies protect themselves a little better.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I don't know. That's kind of a sucky answer to your question. But
it was a hard question. You're right.
Well, I can't answer what I don't know. So, yeah. And in this case, I guess I don't spend a lot of time chasing down these guys who work in the government space, because for me it's frustrating, and it's always we could tell you, but then we'd have to kill you.
Which is a crime.
And then by the time you actually find out what it is they've been so reticent to talk to you about, it's like, really? That
was 5 years ago, you say. Yeah, I know. I was just wondering if you saw these guys operationally sitting around in the Russian chat rooms. And you're like, oh, that's the Fed.
Oh.
And this is the reporter, and those are the actual criminal dudes over there. But I guess not.
I just assume the Feds are on all the forums.
They're listening to them all. That is, in a sense, that it's going by something, but the something has an awful lot of stuff to ponder every bajillionth of a second.
Yeah, and some of them are run by our government or others,
right.
Officially or unofficially, I think. So,
all right, let's stop talking about that before we get ourselves in trouble. So the last question's an easy one. Writing books is a labor of love. I know it because I've done a bunch. Tell me about writing Spam Nation. Was it fun to write Spam Nation? Did you have a good time?
Parts of it, yeah. I mean, since I started... I guess it was probably in 2000, right when I left the Post, and all this information on all these spammers and malware writers fell into my lap. I'm like, okay, well, this is going to be a book at some point. Yeah. I just, couldn't see clearly through to the other side at that point, because it was all I saw was this, Mount Everest of information,
right.
At the top of which I might actually understand what it was I was looking at, but then I'd still have to get down, i.e. write the book.
Right.
And so that's sort of been my experience. I am not one of those reporters to whom the writing aspect of things comes naturally. It's something I've worked really hard at, and frankly was really shitty at. When I first started when some of the stories I was writing to the Post first started getting taken seriously and given really good treatment in the paper, I had one of the editors that actually gave me one of my first jobs there at the Post, older, real old-fashioned newsman, kind of grouchy guy, but great guy. I mean, fantastic individual, and he just so much institutional knowledge in there with this guy. But gruff old newsman, and I'll never forget. He had this funny way of talking, but he said, I think it was the first front page story I had, and he called me into his office, and he goes, Brian, you're a pretty good reporter, but you're
god-awful writer. But don't take that the wrong way. Most reporters aren't both of these things at once. You have to work at one or the other. So.
And he was right. I mean, that was exactly. And then I told this story to somebody I used to work with, and I bumped into him at somewhere, and he goes,
I heard you do a pretty good impression of me.
So then I had to tell him the story he told me over again.
Oh, that's right. You know, the funny thing, he's probably said that to everybody.
Maybe, but it was true. So the writing part of things, sometimes more challenging for me than I would like, but...
All you listeners out there, rush out and buy Spam Nation, written by a guy who doesn't know how to write.
Well, so this is a good example. So, like, I work in an area where, you know, and this is where my training at the Post actually has been invaluable. You know, writing about technology for a general audience is hard.
Yes, it is.
Writing about security and not totally screwing it up and getting it to be understandable by mere mortals is darn near impossible.
You're doing a great job at it, so thank you for doing what you're doing. Well, and we need more people that can do that sort of thing. I mean, otherwise, those of us that are trying to get this accomplished won't get the resources and authority we need to get stuff done. People have to understand the problem.
Yeah. So I guess in answer to your question, the hardest part was, you know, I'd look at all this information that I had and all the facts and all the interesting stuff, like the stuff that like gets me up in the morning and like that utterly fascinates me about what I write about, and then I sort of go through the drudgery of you know, that exercise,
the writing part,
go through on every page when you're writing a book, which is particularly a book about technology and security. And cybercrime is, okay, how does this relate back to the reader?
I've done that 12 times. It's a pain in the ass.
And that was probably it on every third page of the editor's edits in the book. And right. So that was the biggest challenge, I think.
Right. I'm looking forward to reading it. Last question, totally out of left field. What kind of shotgun is it that you keep by your desk?
It is an old-fashioned Remington 870.
Cool. Did it belong to the family, or did you just get one?
12-gauge. No. Got it at the sporting goods store, but it, you know, I say old fashioned because it's got a wood stock and it's a pump action, and you know, it's nothing fancy, but it makes a nice little sound when you do the shoo shock, you know.
Shishink. Yeah. Good. You can tell we're both Virginians. Thanks for your time, Brian. It's been a really fascinating conversation. I appreciate it.
Oh, hey, Gary. Thanks for having me on. This is a lot of fun.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The September-October 2014 issue of IEEE Security and Privacy magazine focuses on CSERTs and incident response. The issue also features our conversation with Bart Miller about open source, Heartbleed, coining of the term fuzz, and analysis tools. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.